Hello, everyone. Ohayou gozaimasu. Okay, so this is the woodworking shop. Oh, no, this isn't the woodworking shop. This is the taiko workshop. You're welcome to sit closer if you want.
That's what I was thinking.
There are seats in the front. So this is taiko, the booming voice of Nikkei identity. We have four panelists, myself, Michelle Fuji, Craig Ishii, and Rick Shiomi. I guess we'll get started. I'm going to go ahead and give a brief background on taiko. So taiko, as we all know, is the word for Japanese-style drums. It's been very, very popular in the community for a while. History of taiko goes way back. In Japan, the first evidence, physical evidence of taiko is these little clay figurines, haniwa characters, that were found in old tombs. And some of them are figures of animals, some are figures of people doing activities of daily living stuff, and some of them are figures of someone carrying what's obviously a big drum with a stick. So, and that's from about 200 common era, so about 2,000 years ago. Drums have been in Japan. Fast forward to modern period, the drums have been in North America ever since Japanese have immigrated, been here in the continent. When people immigrate from Japan, they bring a lot of stuff with them, not just physical things, but cultural things. Their religion, their language, their food, and their culture, including their instruments. So way back, even as soon as there were temples started, you would have a drum that was being played at Bonodori, or a drum that was hit during Oshogatsu, the New Year's celebration and the summer celebration honoring ancestors. So taiko has been here pretty much as long as Japanese have been in North America. However, taiko as a performing art is a relatively new phenomenon. It's even in Japan, it's a pretty much a post-World War II phenomena. So in Japan, what we call now called kumidaiko, or group ensemble drumming, started probably in the early 50s in Japan. Started in the late 60s here in the United States. A gentleman by the name of Seiichi Tanaka and started San Francisco Taiko Dojo. And he was from Japan, Shin-ise, and was appalled because he went to Cherry Blossom Festival and it was a Japanese community festival and there was no drumming. And he said, this is just too weird. So he took it upon himself to start drumming. And the next year he performed on a float playing a drum for Cherry Blossom. He subsequently went back to Japan to study drumming more and founded San Francisco Taiko Dojo in 1968, first performing taiko group in North America. The following year, kind of independently, there were a group of people who were down in L.A. at the Hinata Buddhist Temple, down at the Senshin Buddhist Temple, and they formed a group that they called Kinata. So Kinata Taiko, they had the usual one big drum that kept the beat for Bonodori, and then afterwards, they're putting the drum away, and they decide, well, let's hit it some more because it's a lot of fun. And then 4 hours later, they decided that, hey, we should do this more than just once a year. Let's start a group. So they built drums and started their group. One of the things, so they're the first Buddhist temple group, and they were instrumental in helping many, many other Buddhist temple groups form. Tanaka-sensei, the first real taiko instructor in North America, has taught probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people. People who've gone through his training have gone on to start probably dozens of different groups in North America. And even if they weren't his students, he's influenced dozens of other groups, including my group in Seattle Kokon Taiko. Third group was San Jose Taiko, started in 1973. And they were more community-based, young Sansei activists. Several of them were involved in the Asian American movement at the time, early 70s, and were very more community-minded. So those are kind of the three pioneer groups. There's Tanaka Sensei, who is a more traditional, Sensei Japanese-style teaching method. There's Kinara, which is the first Buddhist group and have more of a Buddhist philosophy. Reverend Mas Kodani would say that, when we have Bonodori, we have people up on stage playing drums, we have people in the back flipping chickens on the barbecue. And if you think you're more important because you're on stage playing a drum than the person backstage flipping the chicken on the barbecue pit, you have a problem. You have an ego. And that was his kind of take on Taiko. And then you have San Jose Taiko, which started as a community-based group and very much plugged into the community. And then is now a professional group, but they're still plugged into the community. Anyway, so the four of us are going to talk about different aspects of how does that relate to personal identity, how does that relate to community identity, and is that changing as the community changes? And first we'll have Michelle Fuji, who is the director of Portland Taiko.
Well, thank you. When asked to do this conversation, I was really honored to actually be asked to do this, partly because the idea of identity in Taiko has been quite intertwined from the minute that I first struck my very first don, or my first sound on the drum. And if you've ever played Taiko, if you've ever experienced Taiko, then you probably know. You know that it's a very powerful art form. It's a very powerful expression. It uses your entire body. It's not just about hitting a whole bunch of rhythms. It also is something that is celebrated as a group. And as Stan was mentioning, the idea of kumidaiko. And lots of times when I explain this to beginning taiko players, it's the idea of coming together as a group of individuals, as a whole, that really brings our art form to come alive. And that has been very special. And oftentimes, because of the physicality, because of the musicality, and also because of the ensemble building that it provides, taiko has often brought out to many of the players the search for self, the search for identity. And that, of course, is very prominent, especially for Japanese Americans here in the United States. And also for myself. I will say that the very first time that I played taiko, I hadn't really looked at myself. I hadn't really asked myself some of those questions, who am I? And so when I took my very first taiko workshop, that was the first question that was asked of me, which was, who are you? And oftentimes we hear this question, who are you? And you go, well, how do I explain this? And sometimes it's hard to explain. Of course, people just want to hear that you're from Japan. But when I first played taiko and was asked this question, they weren't asking in the way of where is your bloodline from, but really, who are you? And I was very fortunate to begin with one of the pioneer taiko groups that Stan just mentioned, San Jose Taiko. And that's one of the very first things that they prod you to do, is to look into yourself and then bring that out into the drum. So I feel very lucky that that was my first introduction to taiko, is that it was an investigation. And in a nutshell, who am I? So just to explain that to all of you, I'm a fourth generation Japanese American, a Yonsei. I did grow up in San Jose, California, so I grew up seeing San Jose Taiko throughout all my younger years, but I didn't start playing taiko until my very, very tail end of my high school years. So I actually, although had exposure, I didn't start until maybe a later age in my youth. Both of my grandparents were incarcerated or interned during World War II, Gila River and Tule Lake. And my father's side comes from Hiroshima Prefecture, and my mother's side comes from Kumamoto Prefecture. Now, this nutshell is not something that I actually probably could have provided for any of you before I played taiko. This was something that I discovered as I played the drum and wanted to dig deeper and deeper and deeper. And so for me today, I just thought that when I was addressing this topic, that I was going to provide just a personal lens of my journey, of how I thought about my own identity, and I still am thinking, that's really sort of my end statement as well, that I still feel as if I'm developing my identity and searching through the drum and through my works to dig deeper into asking myself this very first question, who are you? So, like I said, I started with San Jose Taiko. I actually started in 1993. This is just a picture of San Jose Obon. That was definitely one of the prideful moments of my life every single year. Thank you for the lights. When I was in San Jose Taiko, as Stan was mentioning, San Jose Taiko really started from an Asian American sort of movement of identity. And through the drum, they created, and they do still create, music and art that reflects their own voice of listening to today and trying to provide a joyful voice. For those of you who may not be familiar, Roy and PJ Hirabayashi, they were the former co-directors and are definitely my first taiko mentors. They really guided me into looking into myself and finding my own history. But shortly after that, I left for college. And so at college, there I happened to go to UCLA, and for the collegiate taiko scene, which is now quite a scene now. At the time when I began, there were only three groups in the United States. There was UCLA, which is in Los Angeles. There was Stanford Taiko, which, of course, is in the Bay Area in Stanford. And then UCI, Irvine, Joe Daiko. And when I actually began at UCLA and started at a very young Kyoto Taiko, they were just sort of, we're still playing in parking lots and running away from the police when they would come because of noise complaints. So when we were back in the day, this idea from Stanford Taiko came to bring together an intercollegiate Taiko Invitational. And we thought, what is this? We'll just show up and we'll just homestay and we will just see how it goes. At this point, the actual Taiko conference, or the North American Taiko conference, had yet to happen. So this was quite a convergence of us really believing in what could this do and how could this move us. The first one was so moving that UCI Joe Daiko jumped up and said, we're going to host the next year. And then, of course, being my myself and wanting to take the leadership, the following year, UCLA took the third hosting of this intercollegiate. Now they're seeing 19 years. I just went to San Diego to teach at the Asayake Intercollegiate Taiko Invitational, and it's still running so strong. The idea of these peers coming together and bonding. Also, it's a wonderful introduction to leadership and finding own voice. That was really powerful for me as I went through my collegiate years. And also, I had very strong peers in my taiko collegiate time period. And these people are going to come back later on as I speak of my history. But Shoji Kameda, Chris Bergstrom, Masato Baba, Brian Yamami, we all were dreaming of what could taiko be? How can it reflect the voice that we had? So when we got together, that was sort of this dreaming phase. And, of course, we all went along and kept exploring. Now, just to give you a perspective, I just went again to San Diego, and they have about 14 collegiate taiko groups here in the North America. Not all of them can make it to the weekend, but most of them do. They have about over 300 participants. When we first started, there was only 50 of us. So it has really, really avalanched in its excitement of finding a voice amongst collegiate taiko. But for me, one of the things is that I kept wanting to dig deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And so, of course, looking at my family history, I wanted to go farther than that. And so I got the opportunity to go to Japan. So when I went to Japan, I studied with this group called Warabiza. They were known and still are known, but not as much now, for their preservation of Japanese folk traditions and folk dance in particular. And I really was interested in the connections, because oftentimes when we talk about taiko, we speak about how many of our songs come from these folk traditions. Many of the ways in which we use our body, our kata, our form, oftentimes are references of how some of the basics of folk traditions or folk dance exists, I should say. And so studying with Warabiza was that beginning. And there I had quite a very rigorous schedule. I studied dance. And I studied dance with this teacher who is standing or dancing next to me, Shohei Kikuchi, who was then the artistic director of Warabiza. But in addition to dancing, I also studied koto, tsugaru jamisen. I also played, because it's not a performance, in the matsuris in Kakunodate, which is the town nearby. And that itself was really a meaningful experience to see the community come together through spiritual experiences and annual sort of rituals. And also I was able to join Warabiza on their performance to actually accompany them as a taiko player accompanying their folk dances. And being in Japan was a very fulfilling experience. My 1 year actually turned into three. I learned a lot about my history and roots, but I also had to start looking in the mirror a little bit more than I did before. And learning about myself as a Japanese American was sometimes confusing. I had the Japanese blood. I had, of course, the body of being Japanese, but of course, I didn't have that history. And I knew that although I had learned so much, that there was a new voice that I wanted to experience that really reflected how I grew up and what I wanted to recognize. So I returned back to the United States. I spent some time with Taiko Project, which, again, you'll see Brian Yamami, one of the collegiate peers that I spoke of, on Ensemble. This is one of our very first photo shoots that we ever did. I worked with them in most of their premieres, but then Portland Taiko called me over to take on leadership, and I thought that that was an opportunity for me to really think about identity and voice. And so for me, I just wanted to close with just showing you instead of talking to you a little bit about some of the works in which I explore, bringing together movement, and taiko in particular is my interest. But I also have been interested in really thinking of a contemporary voice as a fourth generation Japanese American, and also as a woman, really thinking about gender and taiko as well. If you know of some taiko groups, there's a very masculine form. And for me, I've wanted to reflect multiple voices. So this is an example of the Uchiwa fan drums, you'll see. And with the fan drums, I'm going to show a short excerpt of my work, my original work with On Ensemble, and then how it actually evolved with Portland Taiko. So I'm sure you can see the video here. Well, as you watch the visual, you'll just maybe feel the taiko sound. And I'll just talk through this a little bit as you're watching. So with this, basically that is the uchiwa, which is the fan drum. And This is my work with On Ensemble. I love the mobility of the fan taiko because, of course, you can move around. And oftentimes I used it as a comparison of looking at what can it be used as a comparison to actually a fan itself. This work I did in 2008, the small stage that you see there is actually a 4x4 stage. It's called, the collaboration was 10 tiny dances that we collaborated with, and it's a concept that started about 10 years ago with a choreographer in Portland, Mike Barber. And I love the idea of how the constriction of space could really think of some creative outlets for playing taiko. So I'm going to segue into this next and final piece here. And I'm sort of sad that you can't really hear the sound, but again, imagine the sound as you hear us move. This is from a work, Insatiable, and I created this production this year in March. It was quite an ambitious project for me. No worries. Yeah. And with that, I created the full production of about 60 minutes of work. And in this duet, I really, there we go, yay. So we end on a great note. But just to finish what I was going to say, this duet really challenges some of the areas or sort of physical space that we typically use with taiko. And this goes for just less than a minute, so maybe I could just finish this video. Those are just some real brief glimpses of some of the work that I've done. And really, I feel that my discovery of identity is still going on. It's a journey that continues. And I just wanted to also note and give credit that the person who was doing that duet with me was also my husband, who I met at Warabiza. His name's Toru Watanabe. And that also has been a really interesting dynamic. Of course, he is Japanese. I'm Japanese-American. And so for us to be creating work together in Portland, taiko has been also another place that's been quite a grounding force for me. So with that, I think we're going to move on to the next speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. So Michelle is, personal opinion, I think one of the great creative forces in current modern taiko in North America. She's doing stuff that no one else is doing, exploring new avenues. Next we have Craig Ishii, who's director of Kizuna, which is a leadership training program. I believe he got his start in taiko in college, correct? And continues working with youth on taiko. So I think that'll be his focus.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Craig. So I just kind of wanted to reiterate the theme of the panel because I'm going to sort of be hitting some of the different points. I'm going to give a little bit of my credentials and sort of my background first, and then kind of go into the first point here. we really want to talk about how Taiko has really shaped cultural identity. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about how I believe that Taiko really shapes a foundation for young people who play. Then I'm going to kind of move into a little bit, kind of expanding on intercollegiate Taiko and what I do believe that its role in sort of spreading our community is. And then I do sort of have a few takeaway messages at the end. Some, not caveats, but just some things that I sort of discovered while playing Taiko that I thought would be maybe interesting or, might be good to kind of take away. So just to give a little bit of background, next slide. I started actually at the age of, I think I started playing when I was 10 at Orange County Buddhist Church. That's the slide on the top left, although that picture is from last year. And it really is, the nice thing about OCBC, it is very much a family group. We're not a group that really puts too much pressure on the kids. It really is about sort of enjoying to play Taiko and enjoying it so much that we want to encourage these kids to continue to play once they finish high school. And so that's where I got my start. When I went to UCLA in I had a chance to play with a group called Kyoto Taiko, same group as Michelle. It was great. I think that you folks laid out a great foundation for us when we got there because it sort of made those 4 years of my life. I think that was a big piece of sort of what made it sort of one of the best 4 years of my life. And when we were at UCLA, a little bit more professional than Daion Taiko, we had bigger performances. There would seem to be a lot more on the line. And I think that was sort of the first time when I really, really started enjoying playing Taiko. I really enjoyed playing with my friends. I enjoyed just the idea of sort of performing together with peers and with community. That was sort of the first time that I had kind of felt that. I think growing up with Daion, it was kind of one of those my parents said I should do it sort of things. And plus, their practice is at 8 a.m. every morning, so it was a little tough. Not every morning, every Sunday morning before church. So it was a little tough, but coming to UCLA definitely was sort of a big wake-up call that Taiko can be amazing. It can really be something that brings community together. And so after my friends and I finished at UCLA, we actually formed a group in L.A. called Progressive Taiko, and it was sort of meant to be a non-professional alternative for us who just kind of wanted to keep playing together. We wanted to keep hanging out. We wanted to keep having a good time. And so the group is still around. It's a small group, but I left it a couple of years ago, but it was just sort of a way to sort of keep community together. And now I'm currently back at Orange County Buddhist Church as an instructor, and I've been there since, I think, 2007, so about 6 years. And it's been really great to provide these kids with the same experience that I had growing up or that I was blessed with to have growing up. And so just to kind of reiterate, my purpose today is to really kind of talk about this theme of what does Taiko do for community? What does it do for our culture? And the lens that I want to take specifically because the organization that I work with is all about youth. It's all about cultural awareness, all about building community and building a sense of identity amongst young people. The entire presentation is really going to sort of look at Taiko with that youth lens. And so the first part is I really believe that Taiko is essential in creating a cultural foundation for young people. And it can do it in a really amazing way. So it says, why do we need cultural foundation? I believe that foundation it's sort of like the concrete foundation, the base for them to be involved in the future. So I think when you see someone like Michelle come and say, not only am I with Portland Taiko, but I did that after UCLA, you can see sort of a lifetime of involvement. I think that for a lot of young people, you have to have this foundation first in order to understand why do I need to be involved in the future. And that's what I think that Taiko really does, is it can be really a cool way to kind of get young people to understand that foundation. And so you have a lot of examples of things that can do this. Your religion can lay that foundation. Basketball even can lay that foundation. I'm talking about JA basketball, can lay that foundation. Community service and cultural arts like Taiko. I think that when you play Taiko, there's a certain cool factor to it too. I think a lot of kids enjoy playing because it's different than doing a beach cleanup at the beach or, a painting part of your church. There's a certain cool factor to it that I think really helps kids to sort of identify with who they are as Japanese American. And let's see. So that's kind of sort of point number one. When we sort of talk about, it's sort of that first pair or that first sentence of the workshop description, when we talk about what does Taiko provide for cultural identity, from my perspective on youth, again, I really believe that it's a great way to provide that foundation. So bullet point number one. The second part is I did kind of want to sort of now take another look back at Collegiate Taiko and what it's done. As Michelle mentioned, I didn't know that there was 14 groups now. But the interesting thing is that there are a lot of Japanese-American student organizations forming at colleges. We're calling these groups Nikkei Student Unions. And the idea is that they are Japanese-American interest clubs, which means that folks who want to be part of this community, they get to learn about things like incarceration. But they, you know, also have a good time, party a little bit, but learn about what their Japanese-American identity is to them. These are starting to pop up at a lot of colleges around Southern California. But Taiko is actually proliferating faster than these Nikkei student unions are sort of spreading. And so that's kind of the second sort of what I, from my perception, I believe is interesting about intercollegiate Taiko, is it really is a way for us to start spreading our community. One of the things that I was taught while at UCLA, because our Japanese American student club was not just Japanese people, is that anyone who wants to be part of our community is part of our community. So I like to always give the example of my sister. She's adopted Korean American, but she is part of this community. We have folks who participate in Kizuna's programs who are Hapa. They are part of this community. Even amongst Taiko, there are a lot of people who are participating in the art form who are not ethnically Japanese, but they are part of this community. And I think when we look at it that way, Taiko can really be something that really looks to expand our community. And I really believe that intercollegiate Taiko, looking from that youth perspective, is sort of a shining example of how we are actually sort of bringing more people into the fold. And then the idea is you can see where these guys are playing. They're playing at Manzanar, right? If we can sort of incorporate this idea of what is the foundation into the spread of Taiko, then it really gives us a chance to kind of not only be more inclusive, but to really sort of, again, expand what it means to be Japanese American, expand the Japanese American community. So that's my second bullet point. Now, the last is some takeaway messages that I kind of wanted to just sort of put in the presentation. They're sort of just broken down into smaller bullet points here. But really, I believe that Taiko exists as an art for community's sake. I think it is an art, but I also do believe that it has a role in the future of our community and in community service. I think that when we look at teaching Taiko, what's my next slide here? Yeah, this is a good one. When we look at teaching Taiko, I think it's incredibly important for us to not just teach the art form itself, to not just say this is the don, this is the kata, it's important for us to teach about the historical background of Taiko. It's important for us to teach about Taiko's role in our community. It's important for us to teach about what does it mean to be Japanese American? Because I think that we have to provide that foundation in with the activity. And if I'm going to go back like 10 slides, I think it's important for us to do that with basketball. I think it's important for us to do that with baseball, with Boy Scouts, with our church groups. It can't just be about the religion or about learning your knots or about, you know, your form or shooting the free throw right. We have to start teaching our young people, how do these activities really form the framework of our community? How do they really help you sort of discover your identity? I think that as we look at our Taiko groups, especially with young people, it's incredibly important for us to insert that part of our curriculum into the curriculum of the art itself. Couple other ones. I think it's important for us as Taiko groups too to also even think about the gigs and the performances that we take. I know that Okay, I'll go there. I know that with Taiko groups, you sort of run the gamut. On one hand, you perform at your obons and your hanamatsuris. And even with Kyoto when I was in there, we perform for some weddings, but we also perform for some gigs that we really should not have performed at. Right? People come up. This guy came up to me one time and he said, "Oh, you guys are just so primal. You know, it's just a really primal art form." And he was the one who was paying us for a performance, so I couldn't be like, okay, you just want to say we're Oriental. Just say it. But I think it's important for us, especially with youth and with young people, to really think about the type of gigs that we take, right? And then also when somebody comes up to you and says, you know, "I really enjoyed the heart and the spirit of the Taiko drum today," you can kind of say, well, you know, Taiko is actually very much a Japanese-American art form. It's important to do that with your gigs, and it's also important to really kind of pick and choose which ones you take. I think that's a second takeaway. I'm actually going to be done in 20 seconds. And the last I think it's really important for us. This is one of my best friends, but it's important for us to think about, how are we giving back? How is your team giving back? Is it just about Taiko? And is it just about playing? Or is your Taiko group a community group? And I know that when I was at UCLA, we did a lot of performances both on campus and off that were about community building. There would be student elections on campus, student rallies. Kyoto Taiko would be part of that. This last slide here, this is actually an Alzheimer's walk that Maria Shriver hosts in Long Beach every year. Our group also performs like the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure. It's great to get these kids thinking about that we're performing for a cause in a lot of cases. And we're not being paid, but it's something that this group is doing for community. And I think that that's basically it, but those are some takeaways. But I think that if we really look at youth development and we look at how Taiko really kind of connects to that, again, I think that Taiko can really be a great way for us to not only spread community, but to really get young people to understand who they are and when they give back as well. So that's my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. I think, yeah, there's been a proliferation of youth Taiko groups. In the beginning, it was all adult groups, but now there's a whole lot of youth Taiko groups, and I think Craig laid out a really good explanation of why that's so important for community. Okay, now we have Rick Shiomi. Rick's a longtime Taiko player. He's helped form the first Taiko group in Canada, Katari Taiko. He's played with San Francisco Taiko Dojo, Tanaka Sensei. He started his own group out in Minnesota, Mu Daiko, but he's multi-talented. He's also a theater artist and playwright. So, Rick.
Thank you, Stan. And I do want to just commend Michelle and Craig on really being kind of guiders or people who are really taking care of the, in some ways, the flame of what Taiko started as and can continue as within the Japanese American and Japanese Canadian community in that sense. So that's really important. For myself, I'd say in many ways my journey as a Taiko player came from that kind of source. It's kind of fun because if Craig started when he was 10 and then Michelle started when she was 19, I started when I was 35. And so at that point, it's too late to become a really good player. It's probably too late for a lot of things, actually, but I won't go into that. But in any case, it was in some ways an inadvertent start, in a sense. Many of you are still part of that. Back in the late 70s, when I was a part of the Vancouver Japanese-Canadian community, and basically Asian-Canadian community, I felt like I was a part of that community. I was a part of the Powell Street Festival, which is a festival we started in the mid-70s, or 77, I think. That was a Japanese-Canadian festival that really tried to celebrate and bring up the Japanese-Canadian community and the Japanese-Canadian culture in that sense. So the way it started was, when I say inadvertent, was the fact that one year there was a group that came from Japan to the festival that played Taiko, but it was almost like we never thought much about it. It just happened, and there wasn't much there. And then after that, I know Kenny Endo at some point came through and talked to us about it, maybe even gave a workshop, but I'm not even sure we were thinking then. But then at one point, a group called Ondekoza, which you all sort of know as this famous Japanese group, they were just sort of having their breakout touring out of Japan, and they came to Vancouver, and we hosted them, and they performed. And when I saw them, you don't imagine that you're ever going to play a drum when you see Ondekoza, because they were so brilliant, and they were so powerful, and you think, oh, that's for them, the Japanese from Japan, and it's not for us Japanese Canadians or Japanese Americans, in a sense. But of course, the driver of the truck, this will crack some of you up, the driver of the truck was a man by the name of Henry Nakata, who was a player and helper with San Jose Taiko at that time, which was in their early days. And so he stayed at my apartment, and the joke is that it was the winter in Vancouver, which is very cold for someone from San Jose, and I forgot to give him blankets for the bed, so he had to use his coat. So that was our homestay joke. But we talked with him, and he said he was a part of a group, a Japanese-American group, and that was the light bulb that went off, I think, for some of us. And so I went down to I was going to go down to San Jose, and Henry said, no, go to San Francisco and meet Tanaka-sensei from in a San Francisco Taiko Dojo. So I said, sure. So I went there, and then soon after that, we brought Tanaka-sensei up to Vancouver to give a workshop, and that was really, really, I think, the beginning of what became Katari Taiko. And for us, it was like almost a year of just going through workshops, of just practicing. And even at that point, how early it was that there was some discussion within the group as to whether we would even ever perform, and that we were actually just wanting to play for ourselves, in a sense. So the group formed out of that, and I feel like it was really a group of Asian Canadians, both Japanese and primarily Japanese and Chinese Canadians, who were really looking to have something that was an expression for them of a cultural identity, of a dynamic form of performance. And so Taiko really fit the bill in that sense for us. And so that sort of became the impetus. I myself went down and studied with Tanaka-sensei for a couple of years, off and on, not regularly. And then I ended up, because of my career in theater, I ended up wandering around a bit, and I ended up playing a little with San Jose just as a guest player once or twice. I ended up playing with So Daiko off and on in New York. I was a part of a group in Toronto called Wasabi Daiko, which Shinobu Homa and Lucy Komori started, but also had Leslie Komori, who was a prominent taiko player in North America. So I was a part of all these groups and always feeling like it was a great part of my identity, that I felt that there was something that I could do and be a part of that was both exciting but also kind of helping me to explore my own self and my own identity. And by some really unusual turn of events, I ended up, of all places, in Minneapolis. I was actually once coming through there in 1985 and thought, for a theater gig, and I thought, this is probably the last place in the world I want to be, because I think there were like two or three Japanese Americans there and a couple of other people. And I once, I don't know if you know David Mura, who's a very prominent poet, writer. He's based in Minneapolis, and I always wondered how he ever survived there. The funny thing is, when I think that, it actually ends up happening to me. And so I ended up in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, and thought that this is for very personal reasons. I was there and married my wife, who was from there, and all of that happened. And so there I am in the middle of what I consider nowhere at the time, trying to figure out what I would do. And what happened is we started, there was another young man who wanted to, a Korean-American young man who wanted to start a theater company. So having experience in theater, I thought, sure, I'll help him. So I started helping him in 1992. And then what happened is in the next year he left. And so then I kind of inherited the company and became the artistic director by default almost, and have been the artistic director since then. But in 1997, I was actually, we were running the company, but some of the members of the theater members of the company actually knew that I had done Taiko. And I had, by sheer chance, come across somebody who was in Kentucky, but originally from California, that was selling drum, that was building and selling Taiko drums, and very cheaply. And I thought, this is too good a deal to pass on. So I said, I don't know if we'll ever play Taiko again, or if I'll ever play Taiko again, but I'll buy this drum for the company. So I bought the drum, and at an open house one time, I played a little bit of a Matsuri or something like that. And some of the theater people came to me and said, would you teach us to play Taiko? And I said, no, you don't want to learn how to play Taiko because it's too hard to do. And it's hard enough running a theater company or building a theater company that we don't have time to do Taiko. But they insisted, and so I said, okay, I'll give you a Taiko workshop, and after that you'll see that it's too hard to do, and we'll all go away and go back to theater. And so we did it, and the weird thing is that I thought, wow, these guys have a sense for Taiko, the people that were doing it. And so they were excited after the workshop. So I said, okay, we'll keep doing the workshop. So I kept teaching them, and I was teaching for about 3 or 4 months. And finally, there was like 4 or 5 of them involved with the theater company that were doing this taiko. And so then at some point, he said, okay, we'll give a performance. So we gave our own concert like 6 months after we started. I thought, oh, well, that'll be the end of it. So we'll do the concert. Nice try. We'll all go back to doing theater. But the funny thing is my wife, who is, to me, a great muse for understanding art and understanding what works in theater, I talked to her after the performance, after this concert, and she said, this is a gold mine. It's like, look at how excited all the people are. Look at how excited the players are. I said, oh, no. So I said, okay, we will keep doing it then. They want to do it, we'll keep doing it. So we started, and it was like actually a snowball rolling downhill. It just started taking off. People loved it. We got more people joining the group. It became a really exciting kind of thing. And audiences, mostly non-Asian audiences, mostly non-Japanese audiences, were coming to see it and loving it. It was to them. And it's hard to judge whether they're sitting there thinking, oh, how exotic, these all Asians jumping around and playing drums, or whether they're actually beginning to understand something that we're trying to accomplish as Asian American performers, in a sense. So it was really an interesting process, but it really was something that built up very quickly. But the thing that we are now facing, and this is like 15 years later, but actually, you know, I would say after about the first 5 years, we started teaching classes as a general, open to the public kind of activity. And that's an interesting process because there's a certain kind of, I wouldn't say division, but sensibility within the taiko community. And that is that the taiko community, because it's coming out of the Japanese-American community and largely the Asian-American community, is that the classes people are teaching or the workshops people are teaching are aimed at those communities. And so you may have 20 people in a workshop, but 15 of them are Asian-American. And they're very selective in that sense. Ours, on the other hand, in some ways were like Tanaka Sensei's attitude was he would teach anybody that was willing to learn under him, which was a challenge because he had a very peculiar style, or a very idiosyncratic style. But he would teach anyone. And so there were a number of non-Asian players who got their start through San Francisco Taiko Dojo through him. And so then what happens is, but that's in San Francisco. So it's still a relatively, you know, it's still a relatively within the Asian American, the Japanese American community. But you move to Minneapolis and suddenly the framework is completely different. You have a very small Japanese American community. You have a larger growing awareness within the non-Asian American community of this art form and their interest in it. So then we start teaching public classes and suddenly 90% of our students are white. And they just love taiko. They're going crazy over taiko. And I'm looking thinking, wow, what's happening here? And so there's this idea that Craig is talking about certainly within the Asian American community, there's an expansion of what the Japanese-American culture can bring to that community. But if you bring it to the larger sort of non-Asian, the larger society, then even more different things are happening. And that becomes an issue. What is their identity playing taiko? And so those are huge questions now, I think, that our company is facing and we're thinking about. And so what happens now is even Mudaiko, our performing group, is more than half non-Asian American, not even Asian American. So it's an interesting question that we are now sort of trying to struggle with and deal with and think about what do we want to accomplish in a sense. What is the purpose of taiko? What is the purpose of its relationship to identity in America today? So those are questions that I think are, you know, if you take taiko outside of the Asian American community, what does that mean, and what's going to happen with it? And I also just go back to one of the things that Tanaka Sensei used to say, and that is he used to wanted to he used to want to get for Taiko what karate has. And he said, and I said, what's that? He said, it's like a green card. Karate has a green card to America, and that is that it is accepted widely by society now. But of course, if you look at karate in America now, it's probably 90% white performers or white art practitioners of the art form, of the martial art form in that sense. So it's an interesting phenomenon. And I wonder if I ask Tanaka Sensei now, is that what he wants for Taiko? And what would that mean for Taiko in America? Would be an interesting question. And somehow inadvertently, Mudaiko, our group, has come upon that question. And we have to think about what we want to accomplish. So that's one. That's sort of the main sort of question that I want to ask about. But within just a small thing within the Taiko world itself, there are so many different. We think of Taiko as a one. This Taiko is a community thing. But in fact, Taiko is becoming much more of an art form within the Asian American community. So that individuals and individual groups are starting to proliferate where, like own ensemble, where you have a certain group of players who just want to accomplish what they want to accomplish within the art form. They're not trying to represent a larger community in a sense. So it's an interesting phenomenon that way too. So there's all kinds of things that are going on in Taiko that I think are really interesting. And it's in some ways time now to really monitor and think about what we want to do and what we're trying to accomplish and what's happening with the art form. So thank you.
Thank Rick. Wow. Some really interesting thoughts. Okay, so I'm going to read you a paper I wrote shortly after the first North American Taiko Conference. The first time that we had a huge gathering, trying to gather all the Taiko players in North America, or as many of them as we could get. It happened in Little Tokyo in 1997. I'm looking at Michelle because she was there. Okay, so this paper is called Taiko is Folklore, and it came out of my experience at the Taiko conference and reflecting on what that was all about. Okay, so since ancient times, Taiko has played an important part in the folklore of Japan. Taiko appear in many Japanese myths and legends. It's the principal instrument for the folk music of that island nation. And in recent times, it has also taken root in North America, largely among the third and fourth and now fifth generation descendants of Japanese immigrants. Can folklore survive, and is it still useful to modern day Americans? Is Taiko being used to develop or create a modern folklore here in America? So what is folklore? Folklore can be viewed as the accumulated wisdom, values, customs, and beliefs of a cultural community. Historically, folklore has been passed down across generations, primarily in oral forms, songs, poems, stories, or nonverbal forms, music, dance, carvings, artwork, among common people. That's why they call it folk art, because it's not professional. Folklore may include legends, creation myths, festival dances, parables, nursery rhymes, work songs, odes, sagas of a people. It's an ancient and useful way to preserve and pass on a common cultural heritage, and in this way serves to bind people together into a coherent, sustainable community. Folklore is a tremendous and powerful cultural force. It helps us shape our individual identity, place ourselves in a social cultural context vis-a-vis our neighbors, and locate ourselves in the larger world community. Folklore affects how we view the world and our relationship to it. The loss or abandonment of folklore and the cultural demise that this implies may result in assimilation through adoption of a new folklore, value system, or cultural identity, or it may lead to social chaos stemming from a loss of individual identity, community cohesion, and the resultant disruption of the general social order. In pre-industrial society, folklore was a basic means of passing on traditions, knowledge, and values. In industrial society, folklore becomes a means of maintaining contact with a homeland or preserving a traditional community in a new geographic area and social context. Great migrations and wide dispersal of populations made maintenance and development of traditions and folklore much more difficult. Efforts to eliminate or subjugate a people, as you see in policies of slavery, forced assimilation or cultural genocide often drove traditions and folklore underground, and we see examples of that throughout U.S. history with regards to slavery and Native Americans. But folklore and the people and communities who carry it on have proven more resilient than colonizers, racists, and other culture war zealots ever imagined. Now, however, as we enter the post-industrial age, global mass media threatens to wipe out all forms of local, regional, and even national folklore, replacing it with a corporate-sponsored, commercially profitable pop culture instead. In the new corporate design tradition, values become those of the marketplace. Identity is a matter of selecting your favorite corporate logos, you know, the Nike swoosh, and wisdom, something passed on in TV soundbites from our latest media-made stars. The market imperative strives to create one homogeneous mass, one global market in a world where diversity is defined and circumscribed by America's top 40. In the Japanese-American community, forces of racism, discrimination, and segregation altered and curtailed the growth and development of our folklore. World War II and America's concentration camps almost crushed it. Policies of forced assimilation and cultural genocide, similar in some respects to those practiced on American Indians, took a heavy toll. Nihon Machis and Little Tokyos were destroyed, Japanese language was suppressed, language schools closed, the family structure turned upside down, and anything Japanese became a source of suspicion and shame during the period of mass incarceration and well on into the post-war years. It became intergenerational. Taiko began in the United States largely as a rejection of the notion that Japanese Americans should be ashamed of their heritage. It was a means of asserting one's identity and, initially at least in the 60s and 70s, a means of defining oneself in opposition to the prevalent stereotypes and expectations of society, the greater society, which saw Japanese Americans as quiet, passive, stoic, model minority folks, the ones who didn't make noise, who always worked hard and never complained. Taiko players, however, were loud, proud, emotional, and often politically active. Simply playing taiko became a liberating activity for many Sansei youth. Now, however, taiko is no longer viewed as a rebellious activity, but as a performing art. No longer confined to small community street fairs and church bazaars, taiko now appears in nightclubs and concert halls. It can be heard on TV commercials and Hollywood soundtracks. Fewer and fewer taiko players are drawn to taiko for reasons of personal identity or community service, while more are drawn to the music, the performance experience, or the art. Nevertheless, taiko remains a valuable cultural resource for the Japanese-American community and retains rich possibilities for exploring and developing Japanese-American folklore. Several groups have used taiko to tell the story of Amaterasu, Uzume and the mythic origins of taiko, or address the issue of America's concentration camps. Katari Taiko in Canada, in particular, has done both. In my own work, we have done pieces based on the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, an Okinawan folktale, a traditional fisherman's song, a lion dance, and matsutake hunting, among others. With each piece, we try to provide a narrative or background information on stage or in program notes, to explain where the piece comes from and what it's about. In this way, I try to build a modern folklore series, pieces that can tell a tale, evoke a memory, or spur a reflection relating to Japanese-American history, traditions, and culture. Taiko is a tradition in and of itself. Like Ikebana or Kendo, taiko carries its own aesthetic and inherent beauty. Taiko is rich with possibilities for imparting values, conveying customs, telling stories, and just reflecting on our history. It can draw from the old and develop in new directions, and it's going in new directions. Michelle's work is an example of that. Taiko as folklore can help preserve and develop Japanese-American culture, and to echo the words of John Coltrane, be a force for good in our community. And this may be the greatest challenge and the greatest hope for taiko in North America. So with that, we'll open it up to questions. So they're recording this whole session, so they ask that when you ask questions, you speak into the mic.
Just for information, the Japanese American National Museum in L.A. uses taiko as part of their program for visiting schools and using culture and respect to connect Taiko with the museum. And at present, the museum has enough equipment for 10 kids to come up at a time and play Taiko for about a minute or so, and it's a popular attraction for visiting schools.
Yeah, and the Janum has also did a major exhibit on Taiko in North America, in, I believe, in 95. And there's a video of that at their table called Big Drum.
First of all, I'd like to compliment Stanley and Coke on Taiko on their performance yesterday. It was really great. My name is Art Imagira. I'm from Sacramento, California. I learned Taiko from Tiffany Tamaribuchi when she first started on practicing on rubber tires. Have you done that when starting out? So anyway, I wanted to again compliment Stanley on his performance.
Any other questions, comments?
Were there a variety of Americans in the United States? And okay, Shimoi-san, you were talking that 90% of the people who come to learn Taiko, they are non-Japanese Americans. Non-Asian, okay, non-Asians. I wonder, those people, for what reason they come, and when they think of Taiko, or any general, ordinary American, when they hear a word Taiko, do they think of Japan? Because I'm from Japan, okay? And when we say Taiko, we call it Wadaiko. Because there are drums all over in Asia, like in India and China and in the Philippines. But here in the United States or in Canada, when they think of a word Taiko, do they associate Taiko with Japan?
I would say that they do, but in a kind of distant. I don't want to interpret for them what they're thinking. But here's my speculation. One is that for them, there's this connection to Japan that they find exciting. That Japan or Asia or Asian culture has a certain kind of appeal to a certain kind of American, in a sense. So there's that aspect. It's you could say it's exotic. It's they're doing something exotic or something like that. That may be part of it. They may just feel a deep personal connection to Japanese culture or to Japanese aesthetics in a way. So I think there's that element. But there's also an element of Taiko is a very wild and primal kind of activity. You get to, you know, there's tremendous discipline in Taiko, but actually that discipline always takes you to a place where you can express yourself emotionally in a way. And I think for a lot of Americans, that has a huge appeal. There's also just the fact that, you know, audiences that come, I'm sure, for Michelle and for Craig, that they always talk about feeling the vibration of the drum in their bodies. And that is exciting for them. So there's all these different reasons, I think, why people, non-Asian or non-Japanese American, like Taiko and feel close to it or feel that they want to do it. So I think those are, and they're all positive. I think they're all positive things. But it just, when they're doing that in numbers beyond token numbers, then you start seeing something changing. And that's something we should understand as we enter that point, that sort of part of the activity.
I just want to add to that in the sense that, yes, here in the United States, Taiko, the word itself, is branded as Japanese-style drumming, which is Wadaiko. And Wadaiko is the most common description to talk about the style of artistic form that we practice. But I think, was it 1997 or 1999? I forget which North American Taiko conference, and maybe you can remember, Stan, when an academic came to the North American Taiko conference from a Japanese university, and he actually termed it kumidaiko. And so when actually, that was introduced at this gathering, which especially around the beginning times of North American Taiko, it was real developmental and defining moments for the community. The academic from Japan defined it as kumidaiko because kumi meaning more ensemble drumming. And I think that that really embraced some of the principles here, because wadaiko, Japanese style drumming, in some ways was harder to feel authentic saying we're going to copy Japanese style drumming, because many people were finding their own voice. And the kumidaiko aspect of it, I think, really defined that. And so oftentimes in North America, you'll often, if asked to hone in on what kind of taiko, oftentimes we use more the term kumidaiko here than wadaiko. But I use both just because of my studies both in Japan and in the United States.
Any others?
I was trying to think of a question to ask, because I really do respect what you guys do, and I appreciated the presentation, but I suppose I can't think of one, but I do feel I have a unique voice to bring to the conversation. I'm the only Okada that I know that was born in upstate New York, and I moved to Sacramento actually when I was 12. This is probably going on longer than it should, but I think the first thing I said at my first taiko group was, I didn't know what this was. My dad dropped me off and said, I'll be back in an hour. And I actually I learned with Tiffany Tamaribuchi at Sacramento Taiko Dan for about 5 years. And the funny thing is that I don't feel that I'm a very active member of the JA community, but taiko actually brought me to that. So in terms of, I suppose I sense a sort of fear that the Japanese community will lose taiko to the greater world, but I think that's a good thing, that it will be more inclusive to bring people like me who aren't very in touch with their Japanese side and find some more with that, because I did learn a lot about dance, about Japanese culture, about how to respect your senpai and any number of things there, and that's because of taiko. So I can pay my respect to that. And also, again, love what you guys do. A lot of respect there. So thank you.
So my take on it is that it's not an either-or thing. It's not like we can either open taiko up to the world or we can keep it within the community. Or if we open it up to the world, that means we lose whatever relevance it has to the Japanese community. To me, it's a lot like the blues or, you know, jazz. It's like it originated in African-American community. Everybody does it now. That doesn't mean that African-Americans don't like it, don't play it. There's still some issues about getting recognition for it. But I think, and it's not a choice we have to make anyway. I mean, it's happening. It's already happened. Taiko is a world music. There's at least 6 groups in Australia. There's groups in Thailand and Taiwan and Europe, all over Europe. There's 350 taiko players in Great Britain. So it's a world music. I just got the 1 minute sign, so I think we're done.
Can I add something
real quick?
You know, I think one thing that's important to sort of think about, like when you sort of look at the broader perspective of JA community, though, is it's not just taiko. It is basketball, too. It is even Little Tokyo. It is the nonprofit community. I think all of them are facing a very similar sort of interesting, not dilemma, but interesting sort of future perspectives. Like, just to give the Little Tokyo example, we are a physical neighborhood. But at the same time, we're also rooted in a very sort of low-income neighborhood. A lot of African-Americans moved into the area during internment, so we have that part of our history. But even you hear all these things, are Koreans buying out Little Tokyo, or, you know, what's happening with this, or, you know, a lot of young people here, a lot of, you know, market-rate housing going in. There's all these different pressures on that specific community. And I think the interesting and fun part is how that community is really looking towards a very broad perspective of the future. And again, as someone who's not an expert on taiko at all, I do see some similarities in that sense, is that I think the next generation is going to define just like with all with Little Tokyo, with nonprofits, with basketball, the next generation is really going to find what sort of the new community is going to look like. What is the new sort of definition of what Taiko looks like? But I think it's whatever lessons are taken from here. We should probably share it, right? Because it all applies to all these other areas that are all these other pressures that as the JA community moves down the generational line that we're going to face. And it's kind of crazy, but at the same time, it's fun. But it's a little scary, too. Even I'm scared, like, when we talk about, because our organization is in Little Tokyo. We've been there, well, for the 2 years that we've been since founding. You know, it's really scary to think about the future. But it's optimistic and fun at the same time.
Okay. I think all of us will remain for a few minutes. If you have other questions or comments, you can come up, but I think we'll finish your last one.
I'm sorry. I think it is really encouraging to hear from all of you and from the audience. The root is there. It's from Japan. It's from Asia. But I think there is the message, universal message, and it's a very powerful and strong, and it's a community. It's Kizuna, and it is very encouraging to hear. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.